In this week's podcast, I'll discuss a recent New Jersey Supreme Court case, the case of Banco Popular versus Gandhi, found at 184 NJ 161, which is a case decided on June 27, 2005, involving a question of whether a creditor has a cause of action against an attorney who counseled and assisted his client in transferring assets to the detriment of a creditor. In this case, an individual owned two companies that ran Arby's and Burger King franchises. One of the companies obtained a $550,000 loan in 1997 from Banco Popular. The principal of the business, Mr. Gandhi, executed a personal guarantee of the loan. At this time, he owned two homes with his wife and a mutual fund. After the loan was made, Mr. Gandhi and his business encountered a problem with Arby's, and realizing the potential liability in the event of a lawsuit, Mr. Gandhi transferred his home and other assets to his wife. In the complaint, it is alleged that Mr. Gandhi's attorney told him to make the transfer. The transfer was made in April 1998. 2 months later, Mr. Gandhi and his companies obtained two more loans from Banco Popular, one for $15,000 and a second loan for $750,000. In regards to the $15,000 loan, Mr. Gandhi executed a guarantee that specifically represented and warranted that he had not transferred or otherwise disposed of all or substantially all of his assets. In regards to the second loan for $750,000, Mr. Gandhi also executed a personal guarantee containing similar language, but also a covenant stating that the guarantor shall maintain a minimum net worth of not less than $950,000. It is important to note that when the guarantees were executed, Mr. Gandhi had already transferred his home and the mutual funds to his wife. In addition, in accordance with the bank policies, Mr. Gandhi's attorney was required to execute an attorney opinion letter. In the attorney opinion letter, the attorney specifically stated that he is unaware of any material matters contrary to the representations and warranties of the borrower or guarantor contained in the loan document. Both loans closed. About 2.5 years later, the businesses of Mr. Gandhi defaulted on the note and guarantees, and the bank filed suit. The bank also set aside the transfer of the two homes under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. During the course of litigation, Mr. Gandhi testified at his deposition that his attorney had advised him to make the transfers. Based upon this new information, the bank amended its complaint to bring a lawsuit against Mr. Gandhi's attorney. The lawsuit alleged that Mr. Gandhi's attorney was liable to the bank under the theories of creditor fraud, common law fraud, and negligence. After the complaint was filed and served, Mr. Gandhi's attorney filed a motion to dismiss the complaint. The trial court dismissed the counts against the attorney, and the bank appealed. The appellate division reinstated the bank's claim for creditor fraud and civil conspiracy, but upheld the dismissal of the common law fraud and negligent counts. The bank appealed to New Jersey Supreme Court, which addressed each cause of action in turn. First, the New Jersey Supreme Court held that New Jersey, like most states, does not recognize an independent cause of action for creditor fraud. In order for a creditor to prove fraud against an attorney, it must prove all five elements of a common law fraud tort. Specifically, the creditor must prove a material misrepresentation of a presently existing or past fact, knowledge or belief by the defendant of its falsity, an intention that the other person rely on it, reasonable reliance thereon by the other person, and resulting damages. The bank had argued that it is not required to prove all five elements, including material misrepresentation or reasonable reliance. Rather, under the theory of creditor fraud, the mere bad deeds of the attorney was sufficient for a cause of action. The Supreme Court rejected this argument and found that misrepresentation and reliance are the hallmarks of any fraud claim and a fraud cause of action fails without them. Next, the court reviewed the conspiracy theory for violating the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. I will not get into the specifics of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, but it does permit creditors to void or undo transfers that were made with the actual intent to hinder or defraud a creditor, or transfers that are made without adequate consideration at a time when the debtor is insolvent or makes the debtor insolvent. In this particular case, the bank was successful in having the transfers of the homes voided. The bank contended that since it was successful with a cause of action against Mr. Gandhi, it was entitled to bring a conspiracy claim against his attorney based upon Mr. Gandhi's deposition testimony that stated that he made the transfers upon the advice of counsel. The court held that a creditor is entitled to bring a civil conspiracy claim against an attorney, which would require the creditor to prove that the conspirator agreed to perform the fraudulent transfer, which, absent the conspiracy, would give right to a cause of action. The court stated that a creditor asserting such a claim must satisfy the agreement and knowledge aspect of the civil conspiracy count, plus the underlying components of a uniform fraudulent transfer claim. It is important to note that the court specifically stated, and I quote, an unwitting party may not be liable under a conspiracy theory. Civil conspirators are jointly liable for the underlying wrong and resulting damages. The Supreme Court affirmed the Appellate Division's reinstatement of the conspiracy count of the complaint. Next, the court reviewed the negligence claims. It is important to note that there are two separate negligent claims made against the attorney. First, the bank argued that the attorney was negligent in providing advice to his client. Second, and in the independent count, the bank alleged that the attorney was negligent in preparing the opinion letter. It is important to note that the two negligence counts are based upon separate, although related, facts, which go directly to the issue of whether or not the attorney owed a duty to the bank. The Supreme Court first reviewed the law in New Jersey of when a lawyer owes a duty to a third party. The court relied upon the restatement of law governing lawyers, which provides that a lawyer owes a duty of care to a non-client when the attorney knows or should know that the non-client rely upon the attorney's representations and the non-client is not too remote from the attorney to be entitled to protection. In short, in order to have a duty, there must be a representation made by the attorney, some form of reliance by the non-party, and the relationship among all the parties must not be too remote. After discussing these concepts, the court applied them to the facts at hand. First, the court found that the bank did not state a cause of action arising from the negligent advice given by the attorney to his client. The court found that no representations were made to the bank and that the bank did not rely upon the attorney's advice in regards to the transfer. It is important to note that the first negligent count involved the relationship strictly between the attorney and his client. The court affirmed the Appellate Division's dismissal of the cause of action for negligence based upon the advice the attorney gave to his client. However, the court also reviewed the second cause of action for negligence arising from the attorney's role in negotiating the terms of the later loans and guarantees and issuing the opinion letter in connection with the loans. The court reviewed the facts alleged in the complaint and found that if those facts were true, the bank stated a cause of action upon which relief can be granted. Specifically, the court referred to the opinion letter that stated that after due diligence, we are unaware of any material matters contrary to the representations and warranties of the borrower or the guarantor contained in the loan documents. Clearly, By preparing the opinion letter and delivering it to the bank, the attorney intended the bank to rely upon the opinion letter in making the loan. Based upon the allegations of the complaint, it appeared that the attorney knew that certain statements made in the guarantee were false, since he was the architect of the divestiture of the assets. The following section of the opinion is important to this cause of action. Moreover, the bank asserted a breach of duty by Friedman that was not limited to outright misrepresentations in the opinion letter. If the facts alleged are proved, given Friedman's knowledge of the worthlessness of the guarantee, he had a duty, in light of what he had done and what he knew, either to counsel Gandhi to tell the bank the truth or see to it that he did so, or to discontinue his representation. Friedman could not assist Gandhi in fraudulently securing further loans and, on the facts alleged, overstepped his bounds in penning an opinion letter on Gandhi's behalf. It is important to note that none of the allegations have been proved. The Supreme Court noted this in several portions of its opinion and specifically reaffirmed that this case was based upon a motion to dismiss. In fact, the court states at page 14 that, quote, Friedman may well have some explanation for what he did. We rule only that the bank's claim, with all inferences accorded to them, were sufficient to pass the pleading stage of the litigation. It is too early to tell how far-reaching this case will be. However, it is clear that attorneys will have to be much more careful in counseling their clients on transferring assets. For example, the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act does not prohibit certain types of asset planning. However, once a client has a substantial amount of debt or is subject to a lawsuit, asset protection strategies become much more limited. In the event an attorney adopts an asset protection plan or otherwise provides estate planning to a client who ultimately is subject to a fraudulent transfer act, that attorney risks being named as a defendant in that action under the theory of civil conspiracy. Attorneys will have to perform more due diligence in inquiring about a client's debts and potential lawsuits before engaging in asset protection strategies. This may be problematic for certain attorneys, such as matrimonial attorneys, who are dealing with numerous issues at the time assets are being transferred. An attorney must be careful when transferring assets between spouses when there are outstanding debts due and owing to creditors. A prudent lawyer should consider having his or her client execute a financial affidavit listing all assets and liabilities. It is difficult to determine whether the mere existence of a financial affidavit will provide an attorney with protection. I strongly encourage attorneys that engage in asset protection strategies, estate planning, matrimonial law, and debtor and creditor rights, review this decision and determine its impact on its practice area. Should you wish to learn more about the Banco Popular decision discussed in this week's New Jersey Legal Update, you can contact me at 609-895-7353 or email me at tduggan@stark-stark.com, and make sure you tune in next Friday for another edition of the New Jersey Legal Update by Stark & Stark. In the meantime, visit us on the web at stark-stark.com or njlawblog.com for regular updates on important legal developments taking place in the Garden State.